are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, October 5th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Harvard Professor of Law, Lawrence Lessig, on his group Equal Citizens, which is pursuing a lawsuit to change the Electoral College. Also on the program today, Rexit Watch is on. Tillerson reportedly in a suicide pact. Meanwhile, the DOJ investigates Harvard's affirmative action program and reverses protections for transgender employees. Republican donors pissed, but that doesn't mean the party isn't getting stronger. And anti-abortion for thee, but not for me, GOP congressman to resign and spend more time with his ladies.
But hopefully not any offspring.
And we may see some minor movement on minor gun regulation as bump stock sales soar. And a populist Our Revolution candidate with a big surprise victory in a Birmingham, Alabama mayoral race. Meanwhile, Dems lead in Virginia governor race, but the state house is key. All this and more on today's program, folks. An atypical slow news day today, and we'll have an opportunity to get to, if you missed that Ivanka and Junior story, we will cover that today as well, and a couple other that we didn't quite get to yesterday. But as you know, yesterday the big story, or one of them, one of the eight, was that Rex Tillerson reportedly in July had called Donald Trump a moron. And as the day went on, apparently it came out that he actually called him an effing moron.
Lot of love in the room.
Lot of love in the room. And he went out yesterday to pretend that he never said that. He didn't really even get that far in pretending he didn't say it. He just sort of half apologized for saying it, even though he didn't concede that he said it.
He said I was smart, so he couldn't have said it.
There you go. Let's hear Rex Tillerson's attempt to, what do they call it? To show his subservience, I guess. This is the old, you know, thing where the gorillas, you know, hold out their hand like this to the head gorilla. And here's Rex Tillerson.
Could you address the main headline of this story that you called the president a moron? And if not, where do you think these reports or
I'm not going to deal with petty stuff like that. I mean, this is what I don't understand about Washington. Again, you know, I'm not from this place, but the places I come from, we don't deal with that kind of petty nonsense. And it is intended to do nothing but divide people. And I'm just not going to be part of this effort to divide this administration.
Yeah, I imagine during his time at Exxon, as Exxon CEO, he wouldn't have cared if somebody called him an effing moron.
When I was CEO of Exxon, I mean, people called me a fucking moron. They called me an artard all the time. I don't got time for that. I'm trying to do business at Exxon, so I don't get into this Washington, D.C. stuff.
According to the Washington Examiner, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin reportedly have forged a suicide pact in which all three members of President Trump's cabinet would leave if one becomes a target of the president.
Yeah, let's all go, okay.
I mean, this is just, yeah. I mean, this is just, I don't even know what to say. I mean, it's just, it's insane. It's insane. We're living with the, you know, you hear those stories of the insane king, right? The mad king. And we're living it out now. And just everyone's just, the whole country is being held hostage. Hopefully nothing really horrible will happen. Hopefully.
Wait, so if I, but I'm supposed to, I want to hate each of you individually and humiliate you in turn. But if you all go at the same time, then that, I see what you did
I
there.
I mean, who I
really do hire the smartest people.
Who could possibly be craven enough and ridiculous enough to take that? Nikki Haley. Ladies and gentlemen.
Exactly.
The world's most successful people all have one thing in common. They're hungry for knowledge. They read and they learn at every chance they get. You're one of them. You listen to this podcast at least once a week. Well, introducing the Blinkist app. It's got over 2,000 best-selling nonfiction books transformed into powerful packs you can read or listen into just 15 minutes. You learn the essential ideas from the best books in your field or subjects you never knew you loved, like productivity, business, science. With Blinkist, you can feast your mind on key ideas in best-selling nonfiction books like 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, The 4-Hour Workweek. Actually, that Tim Ferriss.
You like Tim Ferriss.
I like Tim Ferriss. And I've been on, Nikki and I had a diet competition. Whatever. I didn't win. It doesn't matter.
It's pretty clear,
but
clear.
His whole, you know, what he does like a lot of like peak efficiency stuff, yes. Best practices, yes. Whatever. The point is, you could listen to the book in 15 minutes or the key elements of the book. Thinking fast and slow. You can do this on your way home or on your way from your home. Or really, you can do it whenever, there's no law on how you use it.
I actually ran into somebody who uses it. They listen to them when they're out running. Which there made a lot of sense to me.
Not to mention, their team is constantly adding new titles from best of lists, so you're always getting the most powerful ideas in convenient made for mobile format. Blinkist was chosen in Apple and Google's best of selection for 2 years. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for the Majority Report audience. Go to Blinkist.com/majority. Get a free trial or 3 months off your yearly plan when you join today. That's Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/majority. Start your free trial or get you 3 months off your yearly plan, Blinkist.com/majority. And here's a new one. Longtime listeners know that years ago I had a geothermal system put into our house. Because when we moved into that that place upstate, we just had a coal stove in there. And that was, the soot was everywhere. So one of the things about this is that you have to change your filter. We got like a 25 by 25, 1-inch filter. It's like this big. And what it does is it cleans the air in your home. In addition, obviously, to sucking the air back into the machine, the filter doesn't do that. It just makes sure that there's less dust. And one of the things that I didn't know at the beginning was you got to change it every 2.5-3 months or so. Well, now there's finally a service that actually will send it to you when you need them. A filter like this keeps dust levels down, makes less visible dust in your home, but it really is about health. You spend 90% of your time indoors, where concentration of pollutants are two to five times higher than the typical outdoors. You can filter out airborne allergens. If you suffer from asthma or allergies, keeping the air in your home cleaner can make a huge difference. And this service, FilterEasy.com, solves the number one problem with home air filters, forgetting to change them. Your average homeowner changes their filters 1 to 2 times a year. The minimum is 4 times a year. It gives you a physical reminder of having to have clean air in your home. It's delivered to your door. You don't have to worry about the hassle of storing extras, which is a huge pain in the butt. You won't ever forget to change the air filters in your home again, and it delivers the exact size home filter to your door when it's time to replace. You can save on 5 to 15% of home air conditioning costs by keeping your air conditioning and heating systems cleaner, and a good filter does this. Get started today. FilterEasy.com is offering all Majority Report listeners their first delivery of a standard 1-inch air filter for free with free shipping. Never forget to change your air filter again. Visit FilterEasy.com/report. That's FilterEasy.com/report, or you can enter the promo code REPORT on the homepage. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Lawrence Lessig. Now, I interviewed Lawrence last week on Ring of Fire Radio. This is such a fascinating and important topic. I brought it up a little bit with Ian Millhiser yesterday. And, you know, there's some skepticism as to whether or not the Supreme Court will actually rule on something like this. But the plan, and Lawrence Lessig outlines it, is to create a situation where the Supreme Court has to address this. And when we talk about problems with the representation in this country, one of the biggest is that it's winner-take-all electoral college. And so a lot of people's votes really don't count, right? I mean, we only talk about swing state elections for the presidency. Lawrence Lessig has a plan. It's a really interesting thing, and I wanted as many people as possible to hear it. So take a quick break. When we come back, Lawrence Lessig. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig. Professor, welcome back to the program.
Really great to be here, Sam. Thanks.
So, okay. Now, you have, and I think we have probably over the past decade spoken numerous times, back when you were doing Creative Commons, and about maybe 10 years ago or so, I'm not sure, you began to focus your energies on dealing with the fundamental problems that we were having with our government. And that has involved various attempts to get money out of politics, involved a nascent run for the presidency in 2016, or I guess probably 2015. You are now attempting to change the way that we elect a president. What is equal votes?
Well, it's exactly what you said. You know, what I've come to see is that we have to build recognition in our culture that the fundamental commitment of a representative democracy, that votes, that citizens are equal, is denied in our representative democracy. It's denied in a lot of ways. It's denied because of the way we raise money for public elections through private funds. It's denied through gerrymandering. It's denied through suppression of the vote in certain districts around the country. But the most grotesque and obvious way in which it's denied is the way we elect our president, because people voting for the president have different power, the different, you know, weights of their vote, depending on where they vote in the country and what they happen to be relative to the majority of the people in their country. So you're a Republican in Massachusetts. Your vote means nothing for the president. It could never mean anything for the president, because the winner of the Electoral College votes in Massachusetts is always and only the Democrat, and the Democrat gets all of the votes because of this system called winner-take-all. So we're challenging that system, and we want the Supreme Court to take the case and say that the principle of one person, one vote means the state has to give the loser his or her share and in the state, so that on the nation as a whole, we get something close to proportional representation in the Electoral College for president.
So, and we should say that this this dynamic, this problem, does not play out in every 50 states. There's two states that do it differently. Let's just talk about that to highlight, I guess, the problem with the other 48.
Right. So Maine and Nebraska allocate their electors congressional district by congressional district, and then they allocate the senatorial electors. Every state gets two electors for the Senate in a winner-take-all basis. So the winner of the vote in Maine gets two electors and then gets additional electors depending on whether they win or lose in a particular congressional district. Now, that system itself is not great, because that's, you know, for a small state in particular, that's not even proportional. But it's fundamentally different from a state like California, where the winner gets all 55 electoral votes, regardless of the percentage that the number two got in the state.
So where is where is this principle, one person, one vote, where does that live? I mean, because the Electoral College is, it's in the Constitution, but how... But I mean, just explain how the existence of the Electoral Constitution is embedded, the existence is embedded in the Constitution. But how we get, I guess, from the ground to the Electoral College is sort of up for grabs.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Constitution told the states to select electors, gave the formula for how many electors each state gave. And then the 12th Amendment basically says how those electors are going to vote, or the process by which they vote for president. But it didn't specify any rules about how the state allocates their electors. That decision has been made state by state, you know, from the very beginning. Now, of course, the Constitution is one part of our the original Constitution is the first part to our constitutional tradition. But, you know, we had something called the Civil War, and after the Civil War, we enacted some pretty important amendments, and among those is the 14th Amendment with an Equal Protection Clause, which, you know, about 58 years ago, the Supreme Court interpreted to include a principle of one person, one vote, which means you have to have electoral systems that weight the votes of all citizens equally. And three times at least, the Supreme Court has expressly said that principle applies to the presidential selection process. Most recently, in a case you might have heard of called Bush versus Gore. So the idea is nothing new in the jurisprudence, but Bush versus Gore actually opened up an extraordinary opportunity that nobody has yet tried to take to get the court to address the question why winner-take-all doesn't violate that principle of equality.
All right, now I want to put a pin in that Bush v. Gore, because I think just within the past day or two of our talking, there's one more piece of Bush v. Gore is in place, and I want to talk about that in a moment. But so ultimately, is the case going to be come down to a conflict between the Constitution allowing states to dictate how they award the electoral votes and the 14th Amendment?
Well, I don't think it's a conflict. I think it's just a question of what the 14th Amendment requires here. Because, you know, the court... 50 years ago, in a case called Williams versus Rhodes, said, of course, the states have plenary power to pick their electors however they want, but like every plenary power in the Constitution, they can only do it subject to the constraints of the Constitution. So you couldn't have a state that says, you know, we can only have women electors, or we're only going to have white electors. Those are obviously rules that would violate a principle of equality in the 14th Amendment. And so the only question then is, well, what is and how far does that principle extend, especially the one person, one vote principle, when we're talking about systems for tallying up the votes that get reflected in the election of the President of the United States. And so, you know, there are two parts to the claim we're making. One is reminding the court the 14th Amendment applies, and once you see that, you have to say, does one person, one vote affect winner-take-all? And then the second part is to show exactly why winner-take-all is not consistent with this idea of one person, one vote.
Now, we have a similar dynamic with the Senate, no? I mean, we've got people who have the equal if I'm from Montana, I have a lot bigger stake as a voter in what happens in the Senate than if I live in California.
Absolutely. And, you know, both the Senate and the initial allocation of electors to the states in some sense violate this principle of equality. And the court has basically given this part of the story a constitutional pass. It said, you know, we're not going to, 14th Amendment wasn't meant to undo the Senate. And I'd say it wasn't meant to undo the Electoral College. But again, we're not challenging the Electoral College, and we certainly are not challenging the Senate. What we're challenging is the way the states have allocated their electoral votes. So that's not part of the Constitution. That's nothing the framers intended or had anything to do with. It's just a rule that the states have adopted. It's pretty clear why they adopted it. You know, once a couple states did it, you'd be crazy not to do it, because your power as a state is a fraction of what it could be if you don't allocate winner-take-all. Once the states do it, the question is whether what they have done is consistent with the values of equality in the 14th Amendment. And I think what we'll show is that it's not.
Has it been challenged? I mean, we've been living under this sort of, I guess, this tension, right, between the idea of one person, one vote and the Electoral College for, decades, almost a century, right?
Yeah. So it has been challenged. And there was another case in 1969, Williams versus Virginia Board of Electors, that was a district court case, a three-judge panel in the district court. And the parties said winner-take-all violates the Equal Protection Clause. And what that three-judge panel said is, well, yeah, it does all these kind of crazy unequal things, no doubt. But to violate the Equal Protection Clause, the discrimination must be, quote-unquote, invidious. And what that means is they had to adopt this rule with some kind of malicious intent. And typically that's about race or some other suspect class, but even if it's not, you've got to show that they did it with some malicious purpose. And of course, that's not possible to show, since this has been around forever, so that meant that the winner-take-all standard survived. And that decision was summarily affirmed by the Supreme Court. There was no arguments or anything. They just said, yeah, that's fine. And there it would stand, but for Bush versus Gore. Because what Bush versus Gore did was to say, well, one person, one vote applies to the presidential selection process, quote unquote. And because it applies, we have to apply equality to the method the Florida Supreme Court has approved for recounting votes. And that method is different depending on the county in Florida. And that difference obviously creates inequality. And that inequality, therefore, violates the Constitution. Never once did the court suggest that inequality was invidious. Nobody ever even could imagine, you know, what would it be? It's, you know, it's just kind of random which county you happen to be in and happens to get recounted in different ways. So it was a completely benign intent behind the malicious, behind the inequality. But nonetheless, the court said, 14th Amendment requires equality. We're going to have to count this in the same way. You need to, you know, if you had time, you should go back and count it the same way. But you don't have time, so guess what? George Bush is president. So that's why Bush versus Gore creates this opportunity to go back and ask the question, okay, does this violate one person, one vote, assuming we don't have to show anybody intended anything malicious by that standard?
Now, the attorney representing Al Gore in that case, David Boies, is going to have a chance to try and build on that principle, according to, I understand your announcement, the past day or two.
Yeah, that's right. On Saturday, I finally had a chance to talk to David Boies about this case, and he, first of all, recognized how important it was that we try to establish this principle of equality. And then he recognized the opportunity he would have to go back and take Bush versus Gore and say to the court, fine, this is your principle. That's what decided the election in 2000. Let's apply that principle now to the Electoral College, and let's see how the Electoral College stands up against this principle of one person, one vote, without any requirement of invidiousness. So he agreed to be the lead on this, on the legal case. And what we're going to do now is put together the strategy of, like, who and how we're going to make this happen. But we could not have a better lawyer. No lawyer in the world could be better to make this case, not only because he is arguably the best litigator in the United States, but because he has a particularly strong way of making the claim with respect to this particular 14th Amendment question.
Now, when David Boies gets in front of the court, there's in the event that he does, and I want to talk about the sort of the practical steps on how that would happen. But I am old enough and was obsessed enough to remember and bothered by that it's quite possible David Boies gets to the court, makes that argument about Bush v. Gore 2000 case. And at least four of the people on the court then are there now, if memory serves, and will say, well, you'll recall we said none of this counts for any other case. I mean, I may maybe not be the way they said it, but it seemed to me like they were saying that. What of that? I mean, wasn't there at the end of that decision, like, incidentally, this is a one-off?
Yeah, there's this very obscure passage that makes it sound like the rule they're announcing only applies to that particular case. And it's, of course, possible for the court to say it's only going to apply a rule to a particular case. But it's completely inconsistent with the idea of the rule of law. And so rather than interpreting this kind of obscure passage to mean the court was acting completely lawlessly and announcing a rule that applies just so, and applies in a way that just so happens to select the Republican over the Democrat who won the majority, you know, we think we ought to say, we ought to, you know, take them as more honorable and principled than that and say, you announced a whole bunch of principles here in this case. We think you should apply them. And if you're not going to apply them, we want to understand why not. And so, you know, of course, the court can do what it wants, and it's basically immune regardless of what it does. But there's still, we shouldn't let them get off so easily with what would be quite an extraordinary deviation from the obligation of a court to announce rules that constrain both the lower courts and the court itself.
Well, I felt that way from after that ruling. I know a lot of people did and don't want to in any way prejudice the justices for any future visits to the court. But I hope your sense of the parameters in which they can operate are as constrained by the rule of law as you are hope. I hope that is the case. So if that's all right. So now what are the practical steps in which there may be a Supreme Court case, right? I mean, just explain to people, you don't just come up with this idea and say that. And also, who will have standing in this instance?
Well, let's just close the loop, first of all, on this special exemption. You know, so what the language was that the court said was that its decision, its consideration was limited to the present circumstances. But, you know, I clerked for Justice Scalia and the late Justice Scalia. And so I embrace his view. So here's what Scalia said in a very famous law review article. He said, when in writing for the majority of the court, I adopt a rule and say, this is the basis of our decision. Not only do I constrain lower courts, I constrain myself as well. If the next case should come to have different facts that my political or policy preference regarding the outcomes are quite the opposite, I will be unable to indulge those preferences. And that's the standard that I think we should presume they're adopting and applying, and that's the standard we'll hold them up to. Now, how we'll do it? Well,
Now I got to ask you one more question. Do you think Scalia, I mean, this is a little bit off topic, but do you think Scalia actually abided by that?
You know, the Scalia I knew, and I clerked for him early in his career, and so I don't want to represent this is who he was for the whole of his career, but the Scalia I knew, whenever he was confronted with a principle that went against his what he his conservative views, he followed the principle. There were at least three times when I clerked for him where what he wanted to do politically was different from what he eventually did legally, because his clerks basically said, "Look, your principle says X, so you can't do Y. You have to do X." Now, I don't, again, many people think that wasn't true for his whole life, for his whole career. But the deeper point is, it's not about what the person would do. It's what the person is representing the principle should be. And that's the basis on which we should be allowed to argue. Here's what you say the principle is. And if you're going to say you're not going to live up to that principle, then say it and pay the cost. Pay the price of not living up to a principle you articulate. And so that's what we want the court to do. So you said, well, how do we do it? Well, we haven't picked the, we've got a bunch of plaintiffs all over the country who are eager to step up. But what we will do is pick two states which are clear non-swing states. So a clearly Democratic state and a clearly Republican state. And in the Republican state, there'll be some Democratic plaintiffs who say, our vote never counts. And in the Democratic state, there'll be some Republican plaintiffs who say, our vote never counts. And those two plaintiffs will have standing because the counting rule is affecting the meaningfulness of their vote. And the question that will be presented to the court against the state is whether the state's rule for counting is consistent with equal protection.
Is it possible that let's assume so that's how they get their standing. I mean, is it possible that the court could say, well, I mean, it's not like there's anything structural that makes your vote not count. It's conceivable your vote could count. It's just you need to go out there and convince your fellow citizens of the state that they should vote the way that you do, and then all the electoral votes will go to the Republican or to the Democrat?
Well, you could put it like that, although that's a pretty big burden to say that someone has to bear just to have their vote counted, right? What's basically happening is you're saying, depending on what other people do, we're going to recognize your vote or not. You know, what's the difference? So if you happen to be a Republican in a Republican state, that means you got less work to do than if you happen to be a Democrat in a Republican state, or vice versa. And why is that additional work that I've got to do to be able to have my vote counted legitimate constitutionally? Why can't I, like the Republican in a Republican state, just vote and have my vote be weighed in the total for my state, just like the Republican's vote is weighed in the total for the state? So that's the sense in which there's this contingent inequality or this contingent weighting. My vote weighs zero if I happen to be in the minority, and it weighs one if I happen to be in the majority. And that contingent weighting, we think, is just as problematic as if it were just an explicit weighting. If they said all Republican votes get multiplied by three and all Democratic votes get multiplied by 0.5, that would be weighting that would be undoubtedly unconstitutional. So why is this one any different? Just because it says we're going to weight it after we figure out how many people voted one way and how many people voted a different way.
So, and all you need to do is win one of those cases. Is that right?
Yeah, if we win one of those cases, we go to the Supreme Court.
And explain that dynamic, how that, why that's the case.
Well, it's not automatically the case with any question. But if we win one case, then the Supreme Court will recognize it has a job to make sure that the election is not decided in a context where the legal rules are different, depending on where you happen to live. So if we won a case, you know, if we brought it in a state in the First Circuit, and the First Circuit Court of Appeals said, yeah, that's right, one person, one vote violates equal protection. And then a bunch of states felt like they had to allocate their electors differently. That would be something the Supreme Court would not allow to happen without it itself either deciding the First Circuit was right or deciding the First Circuit was wrong. So most likely what the court would do is stay the decision of the First Circuit. They would say, they would say, thank you for your judgment, but we're not going to allow it to have any effect until we've had a chance to review it. And then the court would take it up to review it.
And people should know, when you say the First Circuit, you're talking about multiple states, right? It's Maine and Massachusetts. Right. And
The country is divided into these circuit courts, a kind of weirdly gerrymandered mix of states that all go together, different circuits. And the First Circuit is the Northeast.
And so, all right, so now let's just briefly talk about this this case. How does it impact the push for national popular vote, NPV? Because this is something that people have been, you know, pushing for an extended period of time. It's something that, you know, we've talked about on this program a little bit over the years. This is a compact essentially entered into by, I can't remember the number of states, but enough that only have about control over about 160 or 170 electoral votes. Just explain how these two differ and if there's any conflict there.
There's no conflict because we are both of these movements are motivated, animated by the same principle. And that principle is that all our votes should count equally. And indeed, the national popular vote solution is a more perfect way to make sure all our votes count equally because it determines the result based on adding up the popular vote in all the states, and the popular vote is obviously tallied in a one-person, one-vote way. So there's no inconsistency with it. Instead, what we think we're doing, what we want to be doing, is to complement that movement, complement in the sense of add to that movement, by building, first of all, a movement of people who are animated and demand the idea of one-person, one-vote, of equality and voting power. And those people, once they get focused in our campaign, you know, we're eager to, ask them to help the National Popular Vote campaign. Because what the National Popular Vote has got to do is got to go around and get enough states to sign up to the compact to make sure that they have at least 270 votes committed. And once they have 270 electors committed, then the compact kicks into effect. Now, I believe their latest number is 11 states, something like 165 electoral votes are committed. They've now hit the need to go and convince a bunch of Republican states to join up. And while I'm quite sure that the people in these Republican states, Republican or Democrat both, can be convinced of the idea of one person, one vote, the Republican politicians are not as eager to embrace this principle because they fear they're not going to be able to win the presidency if they don't have this special boost from the Electoral College. So that's, you know, partly why it's taken so long. And I know there's a fantastic movement of people that are about to launch a new campaign next month to really push to try to get national popular vote enacted. And I, you know, want to support that and support it as much as we possibly can. But we're trying to try. What we think is we should try every strategy. We're trying a legal strategy to help rally to this idea. They're trying a political strategy to rally to this idea. But it's the same idea we're trying to rally to.
And before we tell people how they can get involved and support this, is there a fallback strategy that involves? Or is it possible that in these Republican states, and it just so happens that they haven't joined this compact for the NPV, are there provisions in any of the states' constitutions that would offer the opportunity to argue on some, I guess, analogous, some analog to the 14th Amendment, that the state is denying the vote in some way, or the one person, one vote principle? Are there states that have that law embedded in their, I guess, their common law or their constitutions?
There are, and conceivably you could bring such a suit in such a state. It's not something I would support, just because I believe what we need is a national principle. And so if you had, like, the state constitution of California that was interpreted to say you had to allocate votes in a proportional way, the Supreme Court wouldn't have a chance to really apply that principle beyond California, and it wouldn't even consider it because it's California's law. It's not the law of the United States. So you could, in theory, go around to all 50 states, or at least 48 of them, and say, please apply your principle in a way that creates proportional allocation. But it's a really long, expensive process, and what we want is the principle to be recognized in a couple places, and once it's recognized in a couple places, the force of law will say it has to apply everywhere.
Right, but theoretically, right? If you were maybe not California, but let's say I don't know what states have not joined the compact, but if you were to find that extra 100 electoral votes that would compel them to award, I guess that wouldn't necessarily have the same impact. I guess
no, it wouldn't. They've got to join the compact. It's right, not that the electors are going that way; they have to say they're part of the compact.
Fair enough. So how can people get involved and support this? I know that in the past 2 weeks, Equal Citizens has raised almost $100,000. Is that right?
Yeah, we're over the 100,000 mark. We set a goal of getting to 250 by basically another 2.5 weeks. And so, you know, obviously helping with funding would be really important. But I think the most important thing people can do is to sign up and help spread the message. There's, you know, what we need more than anything is mindshare. We need people to recognize not only is this a problem, but it's a problem we can do something about. And we need to do something about it, because there's just something outrageous that we have this system for electing a president that doesn't give every citizen an equal role. And so if people, you know, more and more join into this and begin to help us find ways to spread the message effectively. You know, so far we've only been able to afford my sorry face on videos saying, please help. But what we want to do is to encourage lots of people to produce and create content that drives this message through the social media to everybody. And that's the movement that will actually eventually have the force necessary, not necessarily directly to convince a court, but certainly to convince politicians that they need to fix this problem, and now.
And so, assuming you raise the necessary funds, when are the cases filed? Give me some sense of a timeline that you're looking at.
Well, I can't say that now, because this is going to be now in the hands of David Boies and his firm. So we're going to be meeting soon to figure that out. I would love to do it as quickly as possible. So, you know, we had originally said something like, the anniversary of the last election, or maybe the anniversary of the last time the Electoral College voted. But the critical thing is we need to get this done soon if it's going to have any effect in the next election cycle, because the court is not going to want to change the rules midstream. And so we, you know, that's where we're trying to urgently push to get this in there as quickly as we can right now. So if people want to support, they can go to equalvotes.us. That's equal votes, and then not .org, but .us. And there you can get stuff to share, and also you can contribute to make it possible for us to go forward. And the biggest cost that we face, you know, we're going to get as much legal work for free as we can. Biggest cost we face is there's a big empirical component. We've got to prove the actual way in which this system is harmful. And it's harmful both in the way that it focuses presidential campaigns on just a few states, so the rest of America is not represented, but also because going forward, we think it's probably at least 30% of elections will pick a president through the Electoral College that has not won the national popular vote. And so we think this is a really dangerous structure for a democracy, that we will regularly have presidents who are not representing the nation as a whole. And so those two facts require a lot of evidence to support it, and those people, those experts, don't do work for free.
Professor Lawrence Lessig, it is equalvotes.us. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will play some fun sounds. Just a reminder, another thank you. We won our fifth Best News and Politics Podcast Award from podcastawards.com, and that is a function of you, our listeners. I think, I'm not totally sure how they chose it this year. I know a couple of our listeners said they were voters, but certainly you guys nominated us. So,
I also had some Russians hack the machines.
Well, yeah, of course. The Russians target the machines. We've got some good clips to play for you in the fun half, and you can join us there. Maybe you're just someone who listens to the show once or twice a week, and you say, man, I don't feel too compelled to support the program. And I can say once or twice a week, you're like, it goes away. But maybe you're someone who also wants to have some fun. Who doesn't? What's that fluttering noise? Do you hear that fluttering noise? I hear a fluttering noise in my headphones. But if you like to have fun, folks, join us for the fun half, wherein we have fun and we take your phone calls. You can do all this. You can support this program and get extra content. And also a reminder, somebody said to me the other day, why do I hear commercials? Well, that's because you listen to the free show. If you listen to the member show, it's commercial free. And we are days away from launching our new website, which will make it much easier for our members to find the deals that we have. Because sometimes I get a little bit of grief from people, mostly Ronald Reagan, that he doesn't have access to the deals. So become a member today. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com, jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code Majority, get 10% off. Also, And if you buy your crap from Amazon or Jet.com, do so through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. And also, check out, you can either through iTunes or through YouTube, check out TMBS.
Actually, newly today, you can see it on, or listen to it on Stitcher.
Oh, is that right?
Yep, I just got that done.
He's in the bathroom, so we can call it too much bullshit. But the real official name is, what is it? Too Much Michael Brooks. Yeah. No, The Michael Brooks Show. That's what it is. And so you can listen to it on Stitcher or any of where your fine podcasts are delivered. Or on YouTube. That's a YouTube show. They do it live on YouTube. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know that, Matt. All right, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920. Be right back. Mingle all the time.